Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
We're kidding ourselves if we think people will stop talking.
You're one of the Monterey Five, right?
Monterey Five?
Just the way he said it, you know.
How did he say it?
Like we all have scarlet letters on our backs.
It's gonna get us. It's gonna get us all.
What are you talking about?
The lie.
Hello, welcome back to Still Watching Big Little Lies. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you are just joining us, we are breaking down the HBO series Big Little Lies week to week. We are in, I don't know, the home stretch, the back three, whatever you want to call it for this second season. We are talking about episode 5, Kill Me. And we will only be talking about this episode. We will not be spoiling anything after this episode, even though I have seen a future episode. I promise to keep it to myself. You know, we're just going to talk about it. We're going to talk about some of your emails, some other notes to bring up, and maybe some theories about what's going on with a big cliffhanger at the end of the episode. All right. So let us start with, actually the first thing I want to start with is an observation, that I noticed, someone posted on Twitter, and I cannot find who, but someone pointed out that, Meryl Streep's performance as Mary Louise, struck them as maybe an imitation of the film critic Pauline Kael, who sort of famously had some unkind things, is like the only critic to ever say unkind things about Meryl Streep, sort of when she was first starting out. Not unkind, but I think I was reading some of the comments that Pauline Kael made back in the day when Meryl Streep was starting out. And, it, you know, she called her sort of like glacial and technical and sort of just like a, you know, not someone that you could sort of get absorbed into their performance. And that hasn't, that is actually, I think that is sometimes my experience with Meryl Streep, though not always my, my experience with Meryl Streep. Like sometimes I can observe the technique more than I can disappear into the performance, and sometimes, not, but, you know, the sort of the mousy hair, even the glasses, like some of that is very, looks very Pauline Kael. And then I was watching some videos and I can kind of see it, some of the sort of smiling while saying something very, incisive, is a Kaelism. So I don't know if, is that, what does that change your, if it were true, and I'm not gonna like, you know, say that this is true, but if it were true, Richard, would it alter your opinion of Meryl Streep's performance here?
Well, as a critic, I should be offended, right? I mean, Pauline Kael is, of course, one of the greats, though she was famously hard to win over, but maybe critics should be that. I didn't read her when she was writing, but I certainly have gone back, and she has a lot of wonderful compendiums of her work that I believe Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is one of them. So I don't know. I haven't really seen like videos of Pauline Kael, but if Meryl is exercising some sort of past, you know, bugaboo about Pauline Kael's writing, I think this is a much more interesting version of an artist grappling with critics than, say, I don't know, Lindsay Duncan's character in Birdman, or who is it? Yeah. Bob Balaban in Lady in the Water, the M. Night Shyamalan film, where he plays a film critic that is just like the most like cartoonish, ridiculous version of like what a filmmaker who's been maligned for his past few films might think of a film critic. So if Meryl Streep is indeed doing that, I appreciate the graciousness of her detailing and not just turning, you know, full tilt, you know, demonizing of critics. Maybe we should be demonized, but I appreciate Meryl not doing it anyway.
Yeah, it would be very interesting if this is something that, and I think it is kind of something that's famously stuck in Meryl's craw, you know, which, I mean, on the one hand, I think some of these treatments of film critics in films, as you mentioned, Birdman and Lady in the Water, I don't know, seem a little petty. On the other hand, if you are an artist and someone has said something about you, like, I mean, I know I'm not, you know, I'm not an actress, but I would be that kind of petty and hold on to it for years and years and years, and then be like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do Pauline Kael here. So, anyway, I've read, speaking of Pauline Kael collections, I've got, I Lost It at the Movies, which is a book I really love. So Pauline Kael, worth a read. Karina Longworth has a great, piece on, as you might expect, because Karina loves a Hollywood feud. She has a great piece on sort of the whole Pauline Kael, Meryl Streep, feud, if you want to Google that and read it for yourself. And then also if you want to check out, there's interviews with Pauline Kael available on YouTube that you can look at and see for yourself. You can email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com to let us know what your opinion, if you think Meryl is doing a Pauline impression. I'm frankly like slightly tickled by the notion, to be honest with you. All right, then this email comes in from Eden, and Eden writes in to say, after listening to last week's podcast, specifically the Bonnie and Elizabeth relationship and the metaphors / visuals of drowning and flashbacks, are we as viewers supposed to be aware of this season, that this season the lens has flipped? It isn't the men, husbands, fathers causing the physical and emotional abuse, but now season two balances the scales by having Mary Louise, all hail Meryl Streep, and Elizabeth as dominating mother figures and with abusive tendencies, emotional and or physical. Is the second season going deeper into the complexities of emotional and physical abuse? If so, I appreciate the gender equality philosophy, Reese and Nicole and the whole team in Force and Big Little Lies. They're all action and conveying the story of female empowerment. And Monterey Five are women who are struggling with issues. And basically Eden just goes on to say, you know, she hopes, she thinks it's that it's intentional. And she likes that. What do you think of that, Richard? Do you think that, you know, obviously this is, not book material that they're dealing with. Well, I guess what I'll say to Eden's email before I throw to you, Richard, is to say, we get a bit more of Bonnie's relationship with Elizabeth in this episode, episode 5. And I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but in the book, Bonnie's sort of abusive home life as a child is the piece of season 1 that they left out, that they're sort of diving into in season 2. But in the book, it was an abusive man. It was not her mother. And so the fact that they gender switched that, makes it feel like, yes, this is an intentional study of abusive motherhood, to maybe balance the parry of it all. You know, is that something that feels necessary? Is that something that you're appreciating? What do you think about that, Richard?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, what comes to mind is something I read recently, an interview with, two women who are, I don't know how they've been branded, I guess the kind of alt-left or the dirtbag left or something. And I don't want to get into their politics exactly, but something they brought up was, you know, the kind of broad women's empowerment narrative that you hear about, like, well, you know, if it's a woman running, I'm going to vote for her versus, you know, and they were talking about a sort of Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders dichotomy and whatever. And they were like, well, you know, what about Margaret Thatcher? You know, she was a woman. Shouldn't this kind of like broad, perhaps bland women's empowerment narrative bolster someone like Margaret Thatcher? Cause she beat a lot of men or whatever. And I don't mean beat like physically. I mean, she triumphed over a lot of men in the political arena. And so I think that maybe from that read, what this season is doing is saying that, like, yes, in an abstract sense, women's empowerment is important, but it's also important to notice that that sometimes women within that system or outside of that system are also not acting in the best interest of all women, or at least certain women, or women that we are focusing on in this show, and providing, I guess, some variance and some nuance within that story, and whether or not that's been well articulated, or if it's been a little bit messy and sort of, I guess maybe too easily applied, is maybe something we'll get into as we talk about this episode.
Excellent. Yeah, it's there is a moment in this episode, just to skip ahead, when Madeline Reese Witherspoon's character, when they're having their sort of like murderers meeting on the beach, which strikes me as a bad idea, but when they have that, she says, you know, we'll get through this if we stick together. That's what's gotten us through so far. And it just once again strikes me as how much is Bonnie really included in that? Like, how much has Bonnie really, really been a part of this? We're all in this together. So, all right. The last general observation I'll make about the episode before we sort of like, you know, break it down a little bit beat by beat is this felt like a more kid heavy episode to me. Like, you know, the kids are an important part of the show. They've got some great performers on the show, but I felt like we had a moment, like Sky, especially Bonnie's daughter, has felt kind of absent for me this season. And I feel like we had a check in with all the kids in this episode. And I don't know, if that was intentional, what sort of extra meaning I could derive from that. Maybe some sort of, reminder of what all these women are fighting for in theory. But I was struck especially by like Sky having lines. I was like, oh, she speaks.
The kids entering the picture, and you're like, oh, right. Like the humans that are so constantly being referred to and defended and fought over they're not infants. Like, they are absorbing this. I think about Amabella, you know, asking her mom about the finances, or, you know, the fight on the school, on the playground at school, or whatever. Like, that these kids are absorbing this. And I think that this episode, one of its strengths, which I don't think are that myriad, is the way that it reminds you that, like, a certain cult of parenthood that has certainly been ascendant in the past, you know, 15 years of social media and blogging and all that, does in some ways forget the people that we're talking about, actually, which are the children, and in favor of the kind of praising of the technique and of the sort of, you know, of the parents' choices. And I think that this episode gesturing to each one of these kids kind of methodically throughout the hour, was a smart way to center that, you know, our focus again.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're right. Of course, it's what they're showing us is the way in which, these kids are absorbing, the things that the parents are trying to shield them from. You know, like, you see Celeste having these conversations with her twin boys, and, you know, or Jane talking to Ziggy, and, you know, this isn't the first time we've seen Jane have these conversations with Ziggy, where Ziggy has like had to absorb and learn something terrible, and she has to talk him through it and stuff like that. But when you have stuff like, and I forget her name, but, Madeline Ed's kid come in, that is actually my favorite moment of the entire episode. It's an almost silent exchange where she comes in and she gives Ed a hug, and Adam Scott's like performance as Ed kind of like breaks down but tries to hold it together as he like gives her the snack. That was just like a really quiet, I thought, really beautiful moment that crystallized. And you see something similar when Laura Dern's character, Renata, keeps up a brave face for Amabella, then Amabella leaves the room and she sort of just like staggers with, you know, what she's trying to keep together there.
Yeah. And I think the scene with Ed in particular, because he's had this moment earlier in the episode where, you know, they go to this completely ridiculous couples counseling retreat. They promptly leave and they have this conversation in the car on the way home, and Ed basically lays it out in terms of his pride and, you know, what he's willing to endure, knowing that Madeline, he was never Madeline's most exciting choice, but he was maybe the safest choice. And even still, she kind of violated that choice. You know, he's centering himself on that, which, like, you know, he's a person, he's owed that. But I think that scene as a button to that reminds him and all of us, and, you know, maybe Madeline by extension, that, like, oh, well, there also is this person here, you know, who, who is being talked about in such a vague way, but there she is walking to a kitchen and, like, having a physical presence and touching him and saying, like, oh, I'm here, you know. And I'm not saying that, like, every kid should be able to pressure their parent out of getting out of a bad marriage just out of guilt or out of whatever. But, you know, I think that was a crucial grounding for a big Madeline and Ed episode.
Yeah. So, the younger daughter's name is Chloe. I apologize, Chloe. Yes. You moderate influencer for forgetting your name. But yeah, I just thought that was a really sweet, scene.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Let's talk about, like, maybe let's take it person by person, if we can, talk about Madeline Ed's trip to what I'm hoping was Esalen. Like, she talked about how it was a couple's retreat in Big Sur, and Esalen is this famous institute in Big Sur, and she calls it an institute. There's really no other institute in Big Sur, so let's just, like, pretend that they're doing an Esalen thing, which I love, because Esalen is, if you're unfamiliar, Esalen is also where Mad Men ends. So even if you didn't watch Mad Men, surely maybe you've seen the shot of Don Draper sort of, like, smiling serenely on the cliffside. That's at the Esalen Institute. And I once got kicked out of the Esalen Institute. So I appreciate any gentle dig.
Our Patreon subscribers will hear that full story if we have them.
Sure. Yeah. On the director's cut of this episode, the time I got kicked out of Esalen. But yeah, it's a very crunchy, thing. And I loved that whole hugging scenario. And I didn't love the car ride scene on the way there, her singing Natural Woman. That, like, did nothing for me. But I think the car ride back and sort of Ed talking about being the safe choice, Ed's side of it at least, did something for me there. And then just sort of their wordless, like, we need to get out of here, a reaction to the hugging ceremony. So you talked a little bit about it already, but, like, what do you think of this whole, like, hasty trip to and from Big Sur for Ed and Madeline?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Natural Woman scene on the way there, like, this is something that we've talked about a bit on this podcast, but something I've certainly talked about with friends, you know, just socially about this season so far, is that if you look on social media, all of the actresses who are on social media, like, they have GIFs ready, like, you know, when the episode's airing, like, this stuff, there are all these kind of pre-packaged mimetic moments. And I just can't help but feel, you know, remember when Reese Witherspoon won an Oscar for singing? Like, it just felt like that was a bit, like, forced, like a forced moment for her. Which I didn't really like, because I also didn't really know what it textually was saying about who Madeline was at that moment, or who Ed was, or how they related to one another. Then the scene at Esalen, you know, adjacent program was, you know, reminded me of theater games I used to play and hated playing them in like, rehearsals in high school and college. There was one where you had to close your eyes and walk around and had to find each other, and you had to form a circle just by hands, and I actually had to beg out of it because I was like, I can't have my eyes closed for that long. It freaks me out. And by the drama teacher was like, oh, okay. This kid's really tightly wound, but okay. I appreciated the scene on the way home because I like Adam Scott's performance on the show. And I think it also, did the good work of reminding us that he's not just the put upon party here. Like, he has a pretty grim read of the marriage that is pretty self-serving. He doesn't really think about what Madeline could get out of this beyond the transactional. And then she kind of reminds him there is more to this. Like, I will fuck up in many ways, but that infidelity will not be one of them. And I think she's super honest about herself in that scene. And I really appreciated it. And I think that, Witherspoon is super good in that scene, whether or not you think that that's really consistent with Madeline's characterization prior to, I thought it was a well written and well acted scene.
Yeah, and I like this sort of characterization of Madeline as someone who, passionately fell in love / lust with someone, Nathan, that she swung hard to a position of I'm gonna, make the quote unquote safe choice and picked Ed, and then but we're all human and you can't just shut off your sexuality, which we get towards the end of the episode. We get her thinking once again about her assignation with Joseph and stuff like that. So, that she wanted to make the safe choice and she did. And she does love, I believe her when she says she loves Ed in a way, but that, yes, he is right that there is a part of her that is not satisfied by this arrangement. So I know that's interesting to me. This episode, I'm gonna swing to the next, what I think is a too intentionally mimetic moment, that struck me in this episode. But this episode is the first time that I'm really feeling something that is true of Big Little Lies, both Big Little Lies and Sharp Objects, both, shows we've talked about, both, initially directed by Jean-Marc Vallée, are the ways in which these sort of impressionistic short scenes can kind of just sort of blend, knit together to give us a narrative. This is the first episode of Big Little Lies where I really felt the wheels came off these sort of little scenes where I'm just why is this here? And why wasn't this cut entirely? And what is this showing me? I'm thinking specifically, I'm thinking of the ice cream toss that wasn't, which is, we talked about this on the podcast that there are these paparazzi photos of, or these drone photos or whatever of Reese Witherspoon throwing an ice cream at Meryl Streep, and everyone was waiting for that scene to happen. And then we get the ice cream scene on the street. And there's no throw, and that's okay. It's okay that there's no ice cream throw, but then without that, that scene is completely inert to me and shows me nothing more about the, Mary Louise, Madeline relationship, right? Other than Abigail kind of witnessing it. I didn't really understand why it was there.
Well, when the scene started, and regardless of the ice cream, which is the great loss of 2019 so far, I think, right. That ice cream scene being cut is, at least we have the photos, but is this episode also with Renata, this season has been this process of putting Meryl Streep in front of everyone.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Right? I was going to say that they just broke the story in order to get Renata in a scene with, in order to get Laura Dern in a scene with Meryl Streep.
Well,
broke the story in order to make that happen.
We for sure have to get to that. But when the ice cream scene started, I was like, okay, here's Meryl's scene with Catherine Newton, who plays Abigail, and then it just doesn't do that. It's just, if part of the engine of this season is putting Meryl Streep in the room and watching how different characters bounce off of each other, okay, well, here, I guess, in that order is this scene, and then it just doesn't do it. It felt like it was a thought that had not gone anywhere originally, that they sort of kept in because, well, it's Meryl Streep screen time, so we can't cut it fully, right? Can we? You totally could have. Her saying what a freak or whatever she calls her, how is that any different for when she kind of, you know, yells at her back when she leaves the house, you know, two, three episodes earlier? You know, it's the same sort of beat. And then, and then there was the Renata thing where you're like, what is this? Why is this happening? Like, is Renata dumb all of a sudden? Or do we just want Laura Dern and Meryl Streep in a scene together? Which, sure, we all do, but, like, it doesn't have to be in this, or at least in this way.
Yeah, that was sort of what I was trying to swing to when I got distracted by ice cream. But, like, it felt like they wanted to have, like, oh my God, yes, queen, Laura Dern, Meryl Streep in a scene, oh my God. And, like, you know, Meryl Streep is good in that scene where she's talking about, like, you know, where's all your furniture and stuff like that. But A, it shouldn't throw Renata as much as it does. And B, the whole premise of, like, Renata in that scene with Celeste saying, like, I gotta get a crack at her. I gotta talk to her. I'm like, what are you talking about?
That's so, like, meta. That might as well be Laura Dern saying, I gotta get a crack at Streep, you know? Yeah. Like,
yeah. I was like, the whole thing is this calculated, let's circle the wagons, have a very smart legal strategy. You know, we're talking about the lawyer. We're talking about what works in family court. We're talking about all of this, but I'm just going to, like, throw my oar in here and definitely invite her over to tea. Like, it was bananas premise. I was, anyway. Also, San Francisco Magazine, I don't know if you were surprised, but when Renata finds she loses the cover, is not even in the issue. And then they're like, it's San Francisco Magazine. I was like, I'm sorry. I thought it was like the Forbes. Nation's. Yeah. She was like the top women's magazine. I was like, San Francisco Magazine. No,
that felt petty, and it felt like David E. Kelley maybe not really understanding the media or something. It also felt like so forced that the assistant runs in to interrupt a meeting, right, to tell, and, like, says that this thing that's obviously embarrassing to Renata, like, that didn't feel realistic. It felt like there just to get Laura Dern to play embarrassed, and then indignant, you know, shortly thereafter. And then the scene with Mary Louise with Renata, like, this was like, again, these are great actresses, but is Mary Louise Dolores Umbridge? Like, she's so undermining in this, like, sing-song sweet way that it's like, she becomes a bit of a caricature where it's like, well, big old house, you're a very friendly person, but, like, lovely person, very kind person, but this big old house with no furniture. It's like, okay.
People,
like,
just don't have just tea anymore. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I will say the one thing that I did like in that scene, she's good in her delivery, but the Dolores Umbridge comparison is perfect. But Laura Dern's wordless gesture of, like, what are you talking about? See, I'm drinking tea. We're drinking tea. Tea's happening. I don't know. That was a little bit of good scene work there. But yeah, just overall, other than the Amabella scene, which I thought did work really well, like, that whole, all of Renata did not work very well for me in this episode.
Well, it's a classic season 2 problem where they had, like, a breakout character. You know, when they announced the show, Laura Dern was never, like, one of the big 4, you know, or big 3. Right. Like, you know, it was Kidman, it was Witherspoon, it was Woodley. And Laura Dern was, like, in it too, and that was great, and she's great in it, but she was a supporting character. She was an antagonist, and then later, you know, a kind of ally. But, like, now that they're trying to, you know, bump her up to star status, it's like, well, but, like, maybe the character was never fully realized, and now you're kind of, you know, working too hard to make it work. And I don't want to be too harsh about this episode, but especially because I'm such a huge fan of Laura Dern, but that none of this worked for me.
Yeah. All right. Let's swing back to the start of the episode, where we open. I think we open technically with Jane, but we switch quickly to Celeste, and Celeste remembering another sexual encounter. I had to, like, pause and rewatch a couple times because, like, so she's having sex like in a bathroom stall somewhere. And I believe at first it's Perry and then it's not. Mm-hmm. And so and it's not the bartender. So she's remembering a different, assignation that she had, this time in a public place. and the image of Mary Louise sort of like ducking hastily out of a room. So like the judgment, the sex, the shame, the judgment. And we get it echoed later in the episode when she's talking to Jane, and Jane says something like, it's amazing to me that you could have enjoyed sex with him that whole time. And, Celeste says, yeah, pretty fucking sick, right? Like, you know, which is, I thought was an interesting moment that kind of just hangs there. Like, you expect Jane to be like, no, that's not what I meant. And she doesn't. So, but I don't know. What do you think of like what they're trying to say here about Celeste and her post-Perry sex life?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the sexual dynamic that the first season illustrated was so fraught and charged in a really credible way. And I don't think that they're losing that exactly, but this season seems to be having a hard time further articulating that. And maybe it's because we're feeling the loss of Perry, not as a good person, but as a dynamic character, you know, who's really changing the climate of wherever he is. I think this whole season is marred by the fact that most of it's memory and not, present tense, in the same way. Although the first season relied on a lot of memory too, especially with Jane. I don't know. I think that I was more, locked in on, and not necessarily in a good way, on the other stuff with Celeste in this episode, particularly her legal struggles, where she's retained a lawyer. Renata's obviously involved, and this episode, you know, it really felt like an afterthought. Was like there were two that I could count mentions where, you know, a character said, well, you're a lawyer, you should know this. And it's like, well, you know, see episode 5 of this, you know, that we should have been reminded of Celeste's legal prowess a lot earlier, you know, because this just feels like a sort of gesture toward that while still trying to make Celeste this reactionary, you know, irrational force within this really scary legal proceeding, for dramatic tension's sake, at the expense of a character that's been established already.
Yeah, it's interesting. So we have a few more players in this court case. We've got Becky Ann Baker playing the judge, and we've got Poorna Jagannathan playing, I think her character's name is Katie. Katie Richmond, Celeste's lawyer. Always delighted to see Becky Ann Baker in this role, and I'm less familiar with this other actress, but I think she's quite good as like a very like calm, like, this is how I do, like, her argument makes a lot of sense to me, where she's like, the only way they win is if you look, I don't know, to borrow a Chloe phrase, unhinged. Like, if they get a rise out of you, they win. And that is just like, given the erratic way in which we've seen Celeste, behave in this season, like, that just feels like, okay, you've already lost. Like, how is Celeste gonna keep it together? If we've seen her like so erratic this season, but like, I'm curious about the mention of her legal mind and the way in which I don't feel like she's really applying it fully. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I first want to say that Poorna Jagannathan, is so good in The Night Of, another, well, much darker legal series that HBO did, a couple of years ago. So it's fun seeing her. You know, I just am convinced that Meryl Streep was just like, if we're going to do these scenes with these kind of anonymous actors playing actors and lawyers and judges and whatever, I'm going to get good people to do it. You know what I mean? Or it's just, nice. You know, the show is just like, we can get whoever we want. And I liked the legalese of it. I liked Becky Ann Baker as a judge who was no nonsense. And then Celeste lawyer saying, look, she's a smart woman. She's going to see through that. You've just got to make, you know, maintain calm, which is a sensible thing and a sad thing maybe that someone just can't express emotion, you know, in order to better,
right,
you know, win a case or whatever. But it to then have that dramatic tension released just a few scenes later when Celeste is in, you know, not the judge isn't there in this sort of offer meeting with Mary Louise and her lawyer. It felt like a setup, and then and too quickly it broke that tension. you know, and while Nicole Kidman is good, I don't know. I found myself wanting her back in therapy because I just feel like those are the scenes that really ground Celeste's psychology, and give us a window into what she's thinking. I don't like it as much when we're just watching her react in the moment, sort of outside of herself. It just feels a little bit more soapy, I guess.
Yeah, I agree with that. And then the other sort of soapy thing we should probably talk about when it comes to Celeste is this stuff with her, with the boys, when like one of the twins calls her a bitch at the dining room table. And then she like, you know, does her no yelling, slamming her fists on the table, which we've seen Celeste do before. All to show us. I mean, I think they're trying to show us a woman who's like trying to be in control. And when she's at her best, she is, like when she's talking to the boys later and they're like, should we lie for you? And she's like, no, don't do that. Thanks so much. But no, you know, and then the times in which she's wobbling a bit, like when she's trying to, when she's fearful that they're going to turn out like their father, like this is a big question. Like, what will the sons of Perry turn out? Ziggy's concerned about it. She's concerned about her boys, like stuff like that. But, you know, she is having trouble maintaining the way that a parent needs to maintain in order to like discipline children. And not to say that I would necessarily keep my cool if like my kid called me a bitch at the dining room table, but like, I think that is an example that makes Mary Louise's case for her. And so it's, you know, yeah. Watching Celeste struggle feels real, but it feels erratic in the way that the episode, I don't know. It just feels like I feel very up and down with Celeste and not in a way that makes me feel like, oh, I'm with her, in a way that makes me feel like I don't know what I'm going to get in any given scene, you know?
Yeah, I did really like the scene where she's putting the boys to bed and they have this careful conversation about what they're going to tell lawyers and judges and yes, and to one extent she is guiding them to say they want to stay with her, but they've also told her that they want to stay with her. So she's not telling it a lie. She's just saying, say that, you know? But I think the moment I really appreciated is when they said something to the effect of, we'll protect you.
Yeah.
And oh, she was so careful little to say, you don't need to do that. And I really didn't read that. I mean, I read it partly, yes, as a mother saying to children, like, you're just children, like, don't, you know, that's not your job, that's my job. But I think there was also in there a woman saying to young men, or, you know, boys, but soon to be young men, don't view yourself as that, you know, because if you view yourself as the protector of women, the flip side of that is that you are what? The destroyer of women, the antagonizer of women, you know, it creates in some senses a binary where some men are good and protect women and other men are bad and don't, you know, and maybe that is the world that we live in, or Celeste and the women of the show's version of Monterey live in. But, I appreciated the subtext of that quite a bit. And I feel like that's the show when it's being really smart and deliberate about its language.
I completely agree. And I really like that goes up there with the Chloe moment as like a moment that really hit me watching this episode. And then let us talk about Bonnie, which has ups and downs for me in this episode as well. We get a bit, as I said, a bit more of Bonnie's backstory, Bonnie's relationship with her father. This reminded me a lot of, conversations that you and I had around Sharp Objects. Not to keep bringing it up, but there is this character in Sharp Objects, Alan, who is like the husband of an abusive mother. And the conversations you and I had around like the complicity of the parent who is not the abuser, but like looks the other way when abuse is happening, and how that is in and of itself a form of abuse. And so we get, I really like how complicated some of this Bonnie stuff is, and that like we see her tenderly like tending to her mother, sitting vigil with her mother, washing her mother, all of that sort of stuff. And harboring all this anger and resentment towards both her mother and her father for the way that she was treated when she was young. That feels really real to me. Less real is stuff like, Elizabeth saying, kill me. I don't know. We can get to that. But this stuff with Bonnie and her dad really, really worked for me. What did you think of all that?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I could relate to that feeling of anger at not the aggressive parent, but the one who, from your perspective, didn't quite do enough to get in between you and the aggressive parent, you know? Mm-hmm. I think that's a dynamic we don't see often explored on television or in film. You know, we get a lot of narratives about the bad looming parent. We don't get a lot about the other person in oftentimes who's in the room or in the next room. You know, and there's a reason why you cast Martin Donovan. He has to have something to do eventually. Right. You know, and Zoe Kravitz again keeps really expanding her performance, and it's exciting to watch that. And in terms of her mom saying, kill me, which, you know, as the title of the episode, you're waiting for that line. And when it arrives, it seems like, oh, that's where it's coming from. I don't know. There was a part of me that was thinking, if she's such a spiritual person, believes in visions, whatnot, was she in essence maybe saying, don't kill me physically. Don't kill my body, but like kill that memory of me, you know, kill the cycle of abuse now, kill me in your mind, you know, pretend I'm dead. Let go of it, violently if necessary. Was then she giving permission to Bonnie to have done whatever she suspects she did, you know, last season, or, and does that same kill me message extend to Celeste and Perry? Does it, you know, I think that, there's a reason the episode was called that. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's just in this immediate present tense conversation between Bonnie and her mom. I think it had broader implications, and read that way, which is maybe an overly charitable read. I think it's really interesting. What lost me about the Bonnie storyline this episode, which has been gradually losing me a little bit, is the conversation that Bonnie has with her dad, where it's sort of indicated that, like, well, these visions are actually sort of maybe like a thing. And we've gotten hints of that before, but also then Bonnie kind of seeing it. And it's like, wait, is this show actually going to be supernatural? I mean, I don't think it's actually going, you know, I don't think it's really going to go there fully, but it's allowing enough of it into the story that it dilutes the weight of other metaphor and other allegory, you know, if we're going to really have people just straight up believing in, you know, psychic visions.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm going to take a wait and see stance on that. that's my non-committal stance on that. And it's not so, I love your interpretation of kill me. I love that. That makes it all sit a little bit better for me. I think it's mostly the execution that it just felt very like, a lot of the end of this episode felt very soapy to me. Like Tori approaching Ed in the bar. Bonnie seeing Corey at the police station. Meryl is directed to just sort of like stare menacingly into the middle distance. Some of this Elizabeth stuff is towards the end of the episode. And it just feels very like, what's gonna happen as the music ramps up? Soapier than this show has ever felt for me. I feel like, once again, it's not something that I think the show has needed in the past. Like, we know that there's questions of like, first season was like, who died and who was the murderer? Like, that was like a soapy-ish sort of thing that happened, but it didn't feel like a soap to me, until the end of this episode. Is that something that struck you as well, or how did you feel about all of that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, with this new focus on Bonnie, they were heading somewhere with that, and maybe this is it. I think that the end of this episode was confusing to me because I guess this is a way to talk about the last main character we haven't really spoken about, is Jane. Why does it end on Corey?
Well, I think we're supposed to be like, dun, 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 he's at the police office, unlike the police station. Is he like, ratting on them, blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, but what, like, does he know?
Is that really what it's supposed to be?
That's what I thought. That's why, wow, it felt so soapy to me. Yeah. It feels like, it's like, oh my God, you know, gasp, twist, you know, like anything that Jane's told Corey, maybe he's told the police, you know, about like her sexual assault or whatever it is. That was my interpretation of the, mm-hmm, of the ending.
Well, in that case, I
right? That's how I feel.
I don't like that one bit. You know, especially because it's doubly cruel then to Jane. You know, I think we said last week or 2 weeks ago that, it is nice, I guess, wondering if, or imagining that there is at least one good guy that Jane could align herself with. And if the show is gonna say, well, no, just kidding, like, he's a snitch, or he's that, or he's, you know, whatever that last shot is setting up, I don't know that that represents a worldview that I really like, I guess.
I agree. Like, I feel like we need one guy who's like, not sort of wrapped up, like, cause I did like their earlier scene where they're dancing and then she, like, you know, they initiate, like, sex, so, and she's like, no, keep going. And he's like, cool, you're crying, so how about not? You know, and so, you know, that's modeling good consent behavior. And also him, like, taking them kayaking is very sweet, and playing with the boys, and Celeste talking about, you know, he's roughhousing with the boys, and Celeste's like, oh, my boys miss this. Like, to have, like, that side of Perry that she saw as the good side of Perry, to have that represented in this other character. You know, and that's all there. And then for him to be sort of like roped into the plot in that way, I don't like it. You know, I just, like, give me, you know, and it, you know, this gives me an excuse then to talk about another scene that we haven't talked about that I didn't like in this episode. Another one that I just felt like could have been cut, which is Ed and Nathan sort of like meeting each other, yeah, again and fighting. And I'm like, we have seen this scene 9 times by now. So, like, why does this keep happening? Yeah. Why wasn't this cut with the ice cream scene? You know,
it just feels like wheel spinning and reestablishing stakes. And I think that, you know, as someone who's written, you know, not just criticism, but, you know, in a previous life to some extent, like, dramatic fiction plays and whatnot, I know that trap of like, well, if we just reiterate these dynamics, then I can kind of spin my wheels and, you know, until I find the way that I'm going. And I think that this season, because it's so premised on the memory of last season, and we're now, you know, 2 episodes from the end of things, potentially of the show ever. And I just feel like we're still on the runway. Like, this has not even taken off. And whether that's a fault of my expectation or of the show really not seeming having any idea beyond, let's just do the same thing over again. I don't know. I mean, you know, recently, like, I watched the whole 3rd season of Stranger Things, which I did somewhat reluctantly because the second season, I really liked the first season, but the second season I was like, well, this is just a rehash with some annoying added extra elements. And then 3rd season, while annoying in its own way, like, actually did expand on things, and I found it more enriching, because it actually moved a bit, you know, it made things happen. So maybe that's what a Big Little Lies season 3 would be, and this is just the weird interim season that, you know, they felt they had to do to get somewhere else. But, you know, and I don't want to be down on the show, because I know people listening to this are listening largely because they're fans of the show. And
I know, right?
You know, and I remain, yeah, one. But at the same time, I expect a little bit more from something that we know to have the capability to be really smart and also entertaining at the same time. And
well, yeah, and I think whether fair or not, what Big Little Lies, the hurdle that Big Little Lies had to clear that, you know, Stranger Things season 2 didn't even have to clear is justify your existence, right? Because initially it was a limited series based on a book, and they got through the book, and it was really only, you know, I don't know, quote unquote, supposed to be one season. And so the fact that they said, oh, well, you all liked it and gave us Emmys and, you know, like, you know, everyone had a great time. Well, like, why not do it again? And then a bunch of us were like, ooh, but why? And you have to defend your very existence, Big Little Lies season 2. And I think for some critics, just watching the first chunk of episodes, they're like, it didn't do it for me. And for me, I was like, no, I think they do have things to say. I think the Bonnie story, as I've said all along, I think the fact that they're giving Bonnie more of a like slice of the pie is what makes this, you know, justifies this season. But as we, maybe it should have been like a shorter season then or something like that. But like, as we get into these back episodes, I'm like, I don't know if it's gonna end in a way that's gonna make me feel like it really needed to exist. And, or if they're sort of like burning out the goodwill of a good thing, which was season one. And I also think that, you know, and how can you possibly resist? But I think leaning into some of the memetic stuff that we've talked about, like responding to like the juicy things that Twitter or, you know, the GIF makers or whatever will lash onto, and dishing that up, like, does a disservice to what the first season was able to accomplish. And then, you know, I don't know. I really wish I knew what went on behind the scenes in terms of like Jean-Marc Vallée editing and Andrea Arnold directing. But I think, you know, I can't help but miss what I view as a coherence of vision from Jean-Marc Vallée, where I always trust that everything feels very intentionally in there. And I felt that way with season one, and I felt that way with Sharp Objects, and I'm not feeling that way this season. And so I just, you know, I should not be complaining about a scene between Reese Witherspoon and Meryl Streep on the street, you know, with the, you know, bonus Catherine Newton. I should not, but I'm like, but why are you there? You know, so.
Yeah. In summation, I would say I'm not quite ready to throw my ice cream at this season, but my arm is like cocked and ready to go, you know?
Okay. Yeah. So hopefully we will, I don't know, find more to enthuse about and next week. Yeah. Once again, I know nobody wants to listen to a podcast that's down on a TV show that you really like. That being said, I did want to end on a sort of a more lighthearted note, which is this. If you, Richard, were under attack, from a pernicious Meryl Streep, which of the Monterey Five would you send to have tea with her to try to fix everything?
That is a great question. My initial reaction was Bonnie, because like, I think her like woo-woo-ness would throw her so off guard, but then Bonnie has mom issues too. Uh-huh. So I don't know. I know that it's not quite worked, but I would just keep setting Madeline. I mean, she's an attack dog, right?
Yeah. And whereas I feel like at some point Renata would get it together
and make it work. Yeah.
And really make it happen.
Yeah.
So maybe stumbled out the gate, maybe underestimated Mary Louise a little bit, but I feel like Laura Dern's Renata is the only hope of these five women. So, we shall see what they all have to deal with next week. We will be back next week to talk about, the penultimate episode, episode 6. Richard, until then, where can people find you?
Well, I'm going to be tweeting at Rylaws. I'll be writing for VF.com a little bit. And, but really, I mean, I am on, we are closing this month's issue of San Francisco Magazine, like, tomorrow. So like, I am such strict deadline. Like,
we have to hustle to find a new cover lady. You know, so,
we put so much work into that magazine. So we really need it. Where will you be, Joanna, other than the edit room?
Oh, well, yeah. When I'm not in the edit room, in order to make sure that I sleep at night, I will be in a singing sleep apnea yoga class with Bonnie. A highlight of the episode that I forgot to call out. You can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can find me on VanityFair.com. And we will see you here next week.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then, I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.